and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at KBOO.FM. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective, from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features artists who will be performing at this year's PDX Jazz Festival: Branford Marsalis, David Sanborn, Kenny Barron, Miguel Zenon, James Francis, and Kenny Garrett. The program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium. It can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on Audio, then Podcast, and then scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
Hello, we're Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There's no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word. Or message us on Instagram at @PACUnderground.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Portland parent was arrested by ICE.
Coronavirus continues to spread across the globe.
And in international news, Scotland proposes free menstruation products for its residents.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 26, 2020. I'm Nat Moon.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The father of two students was arrested by federal immigration agents at a school bus stop in Portland last week. According to school board chair Maureen Wolf, quote, two of our students, their parent, walked them to the school bus. The kids got on the school bus and ICE came and arrested the parent, end quote. ICE has made headlines in Washington County recently after a series of controversial arrests of people believed to be living in the U.S. illegally. Federal immigration agents have previously focused on the Washington County Courthouse in Hillsborough before a 2019 Supreme Court order prevented the practice without a judge's warrant. According to Superintendent Sue Reike Smith, the children of the parent arrested by ICE have been connected with Wraparound Services and Latino Network to ensure safe housing and that their needs are met. School districts are required by federal law to teach all students, regardless of immigration status. In 2017, Tagertulalton school board members passed a resolution that declared the school district a safe place for students. The district also trains teachers and administrators on how to respond to federal immigration laws. School officials in the Tagertulalton school district say they are reaching out to lawmakers to ask about legislation that would prevent federal immigration enforcement officers from using school bus stops in arrests. Democratic Representative Suzanne Bonamici said on Tuesday, quote, targeting arrests where children gather is deeply concerning and does not make our communities safer. It only terrifies kids who must now worry about their parents instead of focusing on school. Parents shouldn't have to live in fear of being arrested by ICE while trying to make sure their children safely travel to school.
The Metro Council voted unanimously last night to seek voter approval of a personal income and business profit tax expected to generate around $250 million a year to help reduce houselessness in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. If the measure is approved in the May 19th election, it would be the state's largest ongoing fund to aid the houseless population. The measure would levy a 1% tax on individual incomes above $125,000, as well as a 1% tax on businesses with Portland area revenues in excess of $5 million. The revenue will fund affordable housing aid, as well as short and long-term rental assistance, mental and physical health services, eviction prevention, and other services designed to help people who are houseless or on the verge of it. The income tax would apply to about 80,000 taxpayers in the three counties, with the business tax applying to about 6% of Portland metro area companies. Portland began levying a 1% tax on sales at large businesses in 2019, and a new statewide gross receipts tax for schools kicked in at the beginning of 2020.
This morning, three Portland mayoral candidates met on stage for a debate held by the Columbia Corridor Association. The debate was moderated by Columbia Corridor's Executive Director, Corky Collier. Incumbent Mayor Ted Wheeler and challengers Ozzy Gonzalez and Sarah Ayanarone were all in attendance. KBOO's S.J. Oxendeem brings us this highlight where the candidates offer their perspectives on how to best address houselessness in Portland.
I'm going to stay on the homeless topic for just another minute, mainly because we had essentially the same question 4 years ago at the mayoral candidates debate, and it's still coming up, of course. Somebody asked, the homeless camps that have literally taken over the Central East Side Business District, who's here from Central East Side? Wait a minute, this is the Columbia Corridor Association. All right. So basically, homeless camps have taken over, you know, everywhere, really. And granted, I think they're better than they were 4 years ago, but there's still a big problem. And it's a problem for new and existing businesses. It's a big challenge, and it's very frustrating for every small business owner. What one of your plans will address this? Sarah, can we start with you?
Sure, happy to, and thank you. My offices are actually in the Central East Side. They overlook the train tracks, and I'm watching as our Portland police are out there sweeping the homeless with our tax dollars in a very effective and humane way every single day. I would actually disagree with you that it's gotten better over the last 4 years, Corky. I don't like to see us wasting $22.5 million on no-bid contracts to people who are doing sweeps of the homeless when we could be spending that money on services. I also don't like to see the police hours that we're putting into this because, again, we need police solving crimes, not dealing with people who are experiencing homelessness and then tipping them into the criminal justice system, which we know costs us all a lot more in tax dollars. Under the previous mayor, we did have some efforts to legalize camping in meaningful ways. I think we need to make sure that people are able to stay in their automobiles, because when you think about especially a woman with her children who is experiencing homelessness, the ability to get inside and lock those doors and keep you safe from the elements and harm is very important. I also have included my policies with regard to homelessness in my public safety for all plan. So I'm thinking about how are we keeping people in our streets safe. The housing question is one thing, but making sure that people who are experiencing homelessness are safe while they are unhoused is critical. And you can find that. It's called Rethinking Public Safety on my website. We need to look critically at what we're spending and where. We need to deal with the mental health crisis on our street. We need to make sure that we're not criminalizing people unnecessarily. And we need to make sure that we're not wasting precious money that could be spent on housing and services sweeping the homeless.
Ted, I think you're keyed up for perhaps a little bit of a rebuttal there.
Well, I don't want to blow my whole 2 minutes on rebuttal. I'll just talk about what we're actually doing, which is substantially different than what you may actually be hearing. We do have good partnerships in place. Homelessness is obviously the top priority of my administration. It's what I do morning, noon, and night. I'm very proud of what our collective has achieved. It's not just me as mayor. It's not just the mayor's office. It's not even just the city. It's the partnership. Last year, 7,000 people received preventative services. We moved 6,000 people off the streets. 8,000 people were able to participate in our expanded shelter system. We've made a huge commitment to supportive housing, so connecting the housing with services like mental health or addiction services so that the most chronically homeless will be successful in that housing when we put them there. We know that that is the model that works. It's shown success. And I disagree with those who say the strategy should be to ensure that people are able to camp on the streets. That is not a humane or effective approach to ending homelessness. The way you end homelessness is you connect people to whatever services they need to help them get off the streets, out of the elements, out of an unsafe environment, and into housing with the support and services where they can be successful. That's what our collective, the city, the county, the service providers, our faith community, our business community, we've already agreed that that is the strategy we want to support because the numbers show it works. Now what we need to do is scale it appropriately, and we're doing that. Of course, we're also doing affordable housing. The housing bond you passed, I'm responsible for implementing it in the Housing Bureau. It's ahead of schedule. We've delivered more than promised. We'll do the same at the regional level with the Metro Housing Bond. And we've also worked to do more opportunities for development of a wide variety of housing through the residential infill program and the Better Housing by Design and the 2035 Central City Plan. So we're coming at it from all angles, and we're succeeding.
Go ahead, Ozzie, go.
Thank you. Bravo, Ted. That's fantastic. I wish you would have said all of this stuff 4 years ago, though. It's been 3 years in the making between we've got to put a roof over everybody's head to this is an issue much more than just housing. And we've seen the ramifications of that learning process outside in the city. I think it's true. Leaving people outside camping is not the version of compassion we should be going for. And unlike Sarah, who wants to create a moratorium on sweeps, I'm actually looking for an intervention-centered approach that really looks at lifting people up. I've walked past people on the sidewalk that I recognize, that are family members, okay? And I've seen how much they struggle in and out of the house of my family member's home. They live in the backyard trailer once a month between getting pulled off a sidewalk and taken into a cell to be cleaned up. They go into rehab, and just a few weeks later, I find them on the sidewalk. If that person didn't get picked up every once in a while, I'm afraid they're going to do themselves in one of these days. And there's people outside doing that right now before our eyes. There's people desecrating public space. There's people out there desecrating their own selves. And all we can do is just squeeze our children a little bit tighter and walk a little faster or pick a different street to walk down. There's people out there that are actually taking matters into their own hands as well around this because we as the city are not able to confront this issue. Now, I know it's not humane to be telling somebody, you got to get up, you got to go, and I don't care where you go. That last part is where I think the city owes it to this, to everyone out there to have an answer. And so I do believe that there are some underdeveloped spaces. There's people out there with parking lots that are not utilized 24/7. There's some spaces out there that are available to us. But when we designate these locations, this is where we have to bring the design element forward. This is not going to be an afterthought. It's not a hodgepodge of tents and random tarps, multicolored with things hanging off of fences. We need to have deliberate, intentional answers for pop-up solutions because this is an emergency. And not everything is going to be an occupiable building that takes 2 years to build. We need to have answers right now. And every answer we bring forward today for folks that are already on the curb is going to help for any potential family member or person in this room that might be subject to one of the many countless reasons that people become homeless. The fastest growing population are the elders, and a lot of times it's because their retirement pensions ran out and they're out of money. They've outlived them. That's the fastest growing population out there right now, that and single parents. We don't have an answer for that yet.
That was a clip from this morning's Portland mayoral debate featuring candidates Sarah Ayanaron, Ozzie Gonzalez, and incumbent mayor Ted Wheeler. Other topics covered in this morning's debate included transportation and traffic, jobs and wages, and the charter government. The entirety of the debate and a transcript can be found on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Portland's mayoral election will be held on May 19th.
The low number of salmon and steelhead returning to the Northwest rivers is raising concerns about a future without those fish and the future of the dams along the Snake River. KBOO's Yasmin Kobanoglu has more on the story.
Energy companies and conservation groups want to bridge the divide on a contentious issue in the Northwest, the future of four Snake River dams. This week, utilities and environmental groups came together to write an open letter to the governors of Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington, calling for a collaborative approach to river management. It urges leaders to keep tribes, dwindling salmon and steelhead numbers in mind, as well as the region's energy needs. Frank Lawson, Chief Executive and General Manager of the Eugene Water and Electric Board, said the letter is proof that groups are ready to work together.
You find a lot of different types of stakeholders and a lot of different interests, but we all agree that we have to work together toward some kind of solution and not run off into isolation and only look out for our own interests.
The letter comes just before the release of the Columbia River System Operations Draft Environmental Impact Statement, expected at the end of the week, in which the impact of the four lower Snake River dams on fish survival is considered. This month, Governor Kate Brown also sent a letter to Washington Governor Jay Inslee supporting breaching the dams if it also includes supporting local communities. Conservation groups see this as the best long-term solution, not only for endangered fish, but the orcas that feed on them. Rob Crable, Northwest Representative for Defenders of Wildlife, said this letter shows there's an appetite for breaking the cycle of litigation that surrounds dam management in the region. He added that folks are concerned that the salmon that define the Northwest are in peril of disappearing.
Nobody wants to see that happen, so it's time for us to come up with some big, bold, new ways of doing business here in the Northwest, and people are really opening themselves up to having a conversation about restoring the Lower Snake River.
Other letter signers include utilities and power companies throughout the Northwest, the Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition and Sierra Club, and the Port of Lewiston, Idaho. The letter is available online at medium.com, and Brown's letter to Inslee is at AmazonAWS.com. This is KABU reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Public News Service.
Umatilla County joined Josephine and Douglas counties in allowing signature gathering for a ballot measure to become part of Idaho instead of Oregon. Idaho Governor Brad Little said, quote, "They're looking at Idaho fondly because of our regulatory atmosphere, our values," end quote. The longtime stress between the Portland-Eugene corridor and the rest of the state is becoming more public, evidenced by Republican legislators from those areas boycotting Senate and House sessions. Even if counties vote to support the move, such a change would require both the Oregon and Idaho legislatures to agree, and then the U.S. Congress to approve.
While yesterday's Democratic debate in South Carolina was the usual melee of interruptions and accusations, mostly aimed at frontrunner Bernie Sanders, something was very different: the audience. Apparently, the $1,700 ticket price led to an audience ready to boo Sanders and any attacks on billionaires and to loudly cheer for billionaire Mike Bloomberg. The Bloomberg campaign denied that it stacked the audience with paid supporters amid rampant speculation that the billionaire purchased a portion of the crowd. At one point in the debate, Bloomberg started to say he had bought Democratic spots in Congress, then changed the word to got. Hill TV's Crystal Ball said today, quote, "I think it speaks to the fundamental endemic corruption of the Democratic Party establishment that you had to pay multiple thousands of dollars to just get into that room."
Candidates took to the stage in Charleston, South Carolina last night ahead of Saturday's South Carolina primaries and also ahead of next week's Super Tuesday. Former NYC Mayor Mike Bloomberg took some hits, but Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, the national frontrunner, was the obvious main target. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
Why am I stopping? No one else stops.
Okay.
A loud audience, sharp attacks, speaking over one another, going over time, and joking among moderators and candidates made for an at times strange debate last night in Charleston, South Carolina, ahead of the Saturday's primary. Former Vice President Joe Biden emphasized the time he spent in South Carolina to earn the support of the majority African American Democratic electorate. He's leading in the polls there.
If you don't win South Carolina, will you continue in the
race? I will win South Carolina.
Mayor Mike Bloomberg isn't on the South Carolina ballot, and he aired ads during commercial breaks to reach people in Super Tuesday states who vote next week when more than a third of delegates are up for grabs. Bloomberg continued to receive criticism over non-disclosure agreements with women at his company from Senator Elizabeth Warren and over a stop and frisk from former Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senator Amy Klobuchar, who've both been struggling with their own records on police accountability. But the main target was Senator Bernie Sanders, the national frontrunner, who won Nevada, New Hampshire, Hampshire and the popular vote in Iowa.
I'm hearing my name mentioned a little bit tonight.
Biden and Bloomberg criticized Sanders' votes against background checks in the 90s and for the 2005 law protecting gun manufacturers from liability lawsuits, positions he's since reversed. Warren said Sanders leads now because progressive ideas are popular, but he hasn't proven he'll be able to get them done. And Buttigieg said a Sanders nomination would hurt down-ballot Democrats.
If you want to keep the House in Democratic hands, you might want to check with the people who actually turned the House blue. 40 Democrats who are not running on your platform.
Sanders countered that many popular ideas among Democrats this cycle are ones he brought up in 2016. And his recent refusal to attend AIPAC's national conference, saying the pro-Israel lobbying group's, a quote, platform for bigotry, unquote, brought Israel and Palestine into the conversation about foreign policy. Warren will also skip the AIPAC conference and weighed in.
Israelis have a right to security, and the Palestinians have a right to be treated with dignity and to have self-determination. That is a two-state solution, but it's not up to us to determine what the terms of a two-state solution are.
The foreign policy discussion was lengthy, considering there were no questions on the topic at last week's debate. Candidates, including businessman Tom Steyer, who returned last night from a brief debate hiatus, discussed Russian election interference.
There was a hostile foreign attack on our election last time, and the president sided with the hostile foreign power.
And the White House's handling of the coronavirus outbreak, which health officials warned yesterday will affect the United States. Here's Klobuchar.
Because this is so serious. I'm not going to give my website right now. I'm going to give the CDC's website, which is cdc.gov, so that people keep checking in and they follow the rules.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the Boo. At 6, it's The Underground. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with patchy fog and a low of 38. Tomorrow, early fog will give way to mostly sunny skies with a high of 59. Today in history, in 2012, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, walking home from a store, was murdered by George Zimmerman in Sanford, Florida. After a trial in July 2013, Zimmerman was deemed not guilty by a jury of his peers. The quote of the day is from Erykah Badu, who was born on this day in 1971. Quote, "I have advice for people who are in unhealthy relationships. Follow your heart. It will get you to where you need to be. Sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's easy, the places that your heart takes you. But continue to follow it. Where the train leads, you'll get there."
For the first time, more new cases of the coronavirus have been reported outside of China than within its borders, with major outbreaks in Italy, Iran, and South Korea. A Brazilian man who recently returned from a business trip to Italy has tested positive for coronavirus, confirming the first known case in South America. Yesterday, the CDC warned that the spread of coronavirus in the U.S. was a question of when, not if, and urged communities to prepare. The mayor of San Francisco has declared a local emergency for the city due to concerns about the virus. The decision was based in part on the high volume of travel between the city and Wuhan province in China, the epicenter of the disease. With no vaccine or specific treatment for the coronavirus, various events like Venice, Italy's carnival, sporting events, and concerts are being canceled or postponed. Training for volunteers for this summer's Olympics in Tokyo have also been postponed, with growing inquiries into whether the Olympic Games should be canceled. The number of countries restricting air travel continues to increase. President Trump has refused to appoint a health czar who serves as a point person for what many are considering a pandemic and tweeted on Wednesday that the USA is in great shape. Trump's tweets came hours before CDC officials disclosed a 60th case of the coronavirus in the United States. At a press conference this evening, Trump put Vice President Pence, quote, "in charge" of the virus response.
Five individuals with ties to the neo-Nazi group Adam Waffen have been arrested by the FBI, the Justice Department reported today. Four of the individuals were charged in the U.S. District Court in Seattle for allegedly sending racist and anti-Semitic threats to journalists and activists across the country, and the fifth was charged in Virginia for his alleged part in a swatting campaign. Today's news marks the biggest bust of the notorious group since its founding 5 years ago. In that short time, Adam Waffen has been linked to at least five murders in the United States. The arrest included the current leader of the group, Caleb Cole. The others arrested were Taylor Ashley Parker DePep, Johnny Roman Garza, Cameron Brandon Shea, and John Cameron Denton, who goes by the nickname Rape. Adam Waffen ascribes to a violent white supremacist ideology called accelerationism, which promotes violence to speed up the collapse of society.
A federal appeals court ruled on Wednesday that the Trump administration is permitted to withhold federal money from sanctuary cities and states. In 2017, then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that applicants for federal funding from the Edward Byrne Memorial Justice Assistance Grants must comply with federal immigration enforcement. Multiple states pushed back and sued over the move. The plaintiffs in the case included the city of New York, along with New York State, Connecticut, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Virginia, Rhode Island, and Washington State. The decision by the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reverses a lower court ruling that blocked the Justice Department from withholding funding that the department said was only available to cities that complied with specific immigration enforcement measures. Judge Rena Raggi wrote in the decision, quote, "The case implicates several of the most divisive issues confronting our country and consequently filing daily news headlines, national immigration policy, the enforcement of immigration laws, the status of illegal aliens in this country, and the ability of states and localities to adopt policies on such matters contrary to or at odds with those of the federal government."
A South Dakota Senate committee is rejecting a resolution urging Congress to rescind the Medals of Honor given to soldiers who participated in the Wounded Knee Massacre in December of 1890. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A South Dakota Senate committee is rejecting a resolution urging Congress to rescind the Medals of Honor given to soldiers who participated in the Wounded Knee Massacre. The sponsor of the resolution says senators missed their chance to make history by saying what happened at Wounded Knee was not okay. Lee Strubinger reports.
On December 29, 1890, around 470 U.S. soldiers surrounded Chief Bigfoot leading his people to the Red Cloud Agency in Pine Ridge. A shot rang out, and thus began one of the deadliest massacres in United States history. It happened on South Dakota soil. Estimates range of 150 to 300 Lakota elders, women, and children were killed. Republican State Senator Jim Bolin is a former history teacher. He opposes the resolution, which came up in a Senate Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. He says the decision to rescind Medals of Honor given to soldiers who participated in the massacre is a matter best left at the federal level.
Again, none of these people who were involved in these horrific, horrible, terrible, despicable acts were residents of South Dakota, and none of the orders that were given at any time were, to the best of my knowledge, or what was testified here today, were ever came from anyone in the who was an official of the South Dakota state government, which at that time was only 1 year old. We had only been a state for 1 year.
Of those nearly 470 U.S. soldiers, 20 were given Medals of Honor. By contrast, 27 Medals of Honor were awarded to Marines out of the 70,000 sent to Iwo Jima during World War II. Democratic State Senator Troy Heinert brought the resolution. He's Sichangu Lakota from Mission and says a Senate resolution is reserved for petitioning the state's federal delegation.
To read some of the accounts of, from people who were there, both Indian and non-Indian, they all said what happened was terrible. What I don't understand is the Congress awarded Congressional Medals of Honor for those acts, and we aren't brave enough to say we shouldn't have.
Heinert says rescinding those medals would go a long way in helping descendants of Wounded Knee survivors heal. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre.
The Spokane tribe held a long-anticipated celebration last week over passage of legislation to compensate the tribe for losses incurred after Grand Coulee Dam was built decades ago. Steve Jackson has more.
The completion of Grand Coulee Dam in 1941 meant the loss of homes as the Columbia River rose over its banks. The impact on the culture was just as dramatic. It meant the salmon, a very important staple and icon, would no longer be able to make it upstream to tribal lands. It took decades to convince lawmakers that the tribe deserved to be compensated for its loss. The bill received bipartisan support from Washington state lawmakers, Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell and Republican Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers. 95-year-old tribal member Viola Frizzell remembers when the dam began to flood the tribal lands.
I didn't think I could. I was going to make it, by gosh, to live that long. But it's kind of sad that my friends never got to enjoy everything that's going to be coming. But I'm happy for the younger people that, you know, that will have schools, college funds, I hope. You know, something to go on.
Tribal business chair Carol Evans says the annual compensation could bring the tribe $6 million a year in perpetuity. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A heat wave in Antarctica melted 20% of one island's snow in just 9 days. The heat wave earlier this month intensely affected an island on the northeastern peninsula of the icy continent. New images from NASA show that nearly a quarter of snow cover on Eagle Island melted during the 9-day heat wave. NASA's Earth Observatory said that in just over 1 week, 4 inches of Eagle Island's snowpack melted, which is about 20% of the island's total seasonal snow accumulation. By the end of the period of high temperatures, much of the land below the surface of the island's ice cap was exposed and pools of melted water opened up on its surface. Maury Pelto, a geologist at Nichols College in Massachusetts, said, quote, "I haven't seen melt ponds develop this quickly in Antarctica. You see these kinds of melts events in Alaska and Greenland, but not usually in Antarctica." Similarly, this month, a massive 116-square-mile iceberg along the western edge of the continent broke off from the glacier, likely as a result of warming ocean temperatures. Antarctica also experienced its hottest day on record earlier this month, peaking at 64.9 degrees Fahrenheit.